It's at the egoic wall, the imaginary line where self ends and not self begins, that spiritual dissonance occurs, I explained to both Maggie and Lisa, trying at the same time to get it figured out for myself. The egoic wall has no independent reality. When we stop pumping energy into it, it starts dissolving. That's what ego is, a self-segregated state. And that's the use to which we put our emotional energy. The egoic shell in which we dwell is of our own making, like a force field that requires a constant source of emotional energy. Maggie yawns and goes back to her project at the raised table in the kitchenette. Lisa looks confused. "And what about our mental energy?" she asks. "What about our intelligence?" "Intelligence is subordinate to emotion," I say. "Way subordinate. Even our greatest thinkers seldom do more than justify and rationalize their beliefs. That's why I try to impress upon people that real thinking is not what they think. Real thinking is invariably destructive and pain-causing. It leads to reduction in the buffer zone between these rough surfaces, resulting in abrasion and meltdown. Like an engine running hot without oil, friction is going to build and it's going to result in catastrophic failure. Normally, we are sensitive to even the slightest level of abrasion and make micro-adjustments as necessary. But it's possible to override that autonomic process. We can think our way out of the false self instead of believing ourselves into it.
You're talking about what, exactly? She asks.
You withdrew your investment of emotional energy from that buffer zone, and it started grating and getting more and more heated and raw. And eventually, the machine broke. And here you are. She looks perplexed.
And how did I get here?
You stopped pouring your life energy into defining yourself as a separate entity and allowed yourself to become undefined. Now, all that energy that you wasted on creating and maintaining your segregated egoic identity can be turned to new and much more interesting pursuits. A whole different way of being, of knowing, of perceiving. A whole different way of wanting and getting, of doing and not doing, of interacting with the universe. She shakes her head in exasperation.
But it's not magic. You're not saying that.
Or, as I think, it's all magic. The dream state is a magical place, and we are part of it. We are it. We are not the lowly squatters or trespassers or uninvited guests we commonly assume ourselves to be.
I don't know, says Lisa, shaking her head. I feel like I'm in a movie and I don't know what kind it is, like if it's sci-fi or fantasy or just regular drama. These things you're saying, it doesn't sound like my world. I don't recognize it as reality. It sounds wonderful, but it doesn't sound real. It sounds made up, like something for children.
Which brings us back to spiritual dissonance.
Oh, because my beliefs are coming into conflict with reality. Well, I agree with the conflict part.
You've probably never been exposed to the idea that thought shapes reality, that thoughts are things, and things are just thoughts. A lot of smart people are struggling to understand that there's a mind-body connection. It gets even harder to comprehend a mind-everything connection, or to go even further and see that there's really no mind-everything disconnection in the first place. So, if you were confronted with this sort of thinking in the life you left behind, you might have simply scoffed at the gullibility of some people and forgotten about it immediately. She nods vigorously in agreement.
But everything is different now. Your internal and external situations have dramatically changed. You're talking about miracles, right? Isn't that what you're saying? I'm saying it's all a miracle. We're not innocent bystanders or helpless victims. We are members of the universe, shapers of our dream state reality. The transition to human adulthood is our birth into this reality. It's not just the next stage of what we are now. It's a whole different relationship to our surroundings, our environment, our universe, a truly integrated, co-creative relationship. We do ourselves a terrible disservice by trying to be positive and upbeat and cheerful about our circumstances. What we are now, as we understand ourselves to be, even by the most optimistic reckoning, bears no resemblance to what we really are. This whole thing is really much cooler than anyone has imagined. Compared to our potential, we're still just little monkeys, and nasty little monkeys at that. The most devoutly religious and spiritual people, those who reset their coordinates and retask their lives to pursue spiritual growth or reshape themselves to conform to religious ideals, would seem to be the most likely candidates for the type of spiritual rebirth I'm describing, but they are invariably the ones most effectively shielded against it. Even the most committed spiritual aspirants are seldom more than amateurs and hobbyists, as dedicated to their spiritual practices and ideals as others might be to their model trains or needlework. The most sincere seekers are the most desperate to stay lost. That's the real dynamic at work in the spiritual quest. They're not seeking truth or answers. They're seeking relief from spiritual dissonance. Providing this relief is the lifeblood of the religious and spiritual marketplace. It has nothing to do with truth or awakening. In fact, just the opposite. In the final analysis, stripped of all its holy pretensions, the entire spiritual marketplace is really nothing more than an existential quick lube shop. And while there may be an endless variety in packaging, there is really only one product. Spiritual consonance is what all seekers seek, an end to discomfort, not delusion. But the consonance they seek can only be found in deeper unconsciousness, which requires the reduction of dissonance. There is such a thing as true spiritual consonance, an integrated, natural, and exceedingly desirable state. But acting tranquil and serene has never gotten anyone there, and never will. How is it possible that so few are able to find the only thing that can never be lost? It's not easy. It takes everything we have, and it's the one thing at which mankind truly excels. We're not as brave or courageous as we like to believe. We're not as intellectually well-endowed as vanity tells us. And by our own moral reckoning, we are the least of all creatures. But there is one thing we all do remarkably well. And only when you get clear of it can you look back and see what a miracle of consciousness engineering self-delusion really is. Chapter 19, The Ministry of Awakening. Crime Stop means the faculty of stopping short, as though by instinct, at the threshold of any dangerous thought. It includes the power of not grasping analogies, of failing to perceive logical errors, of misunderstanding the simplest arguments if they are inimical to Ingsoc, and of being bored or repelled by any train of thought which is capable of leading in a heretical direction. Crime Stop, in short, means protective stupidity. George Orwell, 1984. Bob is a spiritual dilettante, someone whose spiritual pretensions are nothing more than a well-practiced sleight of hand, himself deceiver and deceived. Bob and I have been acquainted for almost a week at this point, and he knows that I see him as a dilettante and that I value his insights for just that reason. In fact, as we sit together in gliders on the flat roof of the guest house, he has just finished reading a draft of the preceding spiritual dissonance chapter. "You might want to think about this," says Bob, looking at me over the tops of the pages he's holding. "These amateurs and hobbyists, as you call them, are your audience."
"My audience?"
"Well, your intended audience," he clarifies. "It might not be wise to alienate them like this." "If I have an intended audience," I reply, "it's people who know they're stuck and want to get unstuck, not people who don't know they're stuck and just want to pass the time and pass judgment." He sighs in exasperation. We've been having more or less the same conversation for several days. "And what do you suppose is the difference?" "The former would receive criticism with gratitude, and the latter as a personal attack. Awakening is a process of breakthroughs, and breakthroughs don't come from incense and candlelight and inner peace. You look at spiritual aspirants as those most likely to achieve awakening, but Maya has them so bamboozled that those who seem the most advanced are simply the ones who are burrowing downward the fastest."
"But, Jed, honestly, you can't say things like that."
"Sure I can. This isn't my pet theory. This is what I see. And if I see it, then it's there for anyone to see. All they have to do is look. I can say that. Can I? Open your eyes. Be honest. Take a look."
He's getting more exasperated.
He's fun to exasperate. He's a few years older than me, maybe 50. Well-groomed, well-dressed, well-spoken, well-rounded, and well, everything. He's warm, genuine, engaging, informed, and charming. He's written a book, and it's that, through some chain of acquaintances, which has brought him to me. He's staying at the nicest hotel in the area and driving a rented Land Rover.
"You're making this all seem too cut and dried," he insists, not for the first time. "Like there are only two sides to the issue. But that's a very dangerous oversimplification. When you talk about spiritual aspirants, you're actually talking about millions of people around the world, billions of people, following many different disciplines and paths. Many of these paths ancient and highly revered. You can't just throw all this spiritual and cultural diversity into one box and slap a label on it and declare victory over human delusion. It's not that simple."
That's why I like having Bob around. He says things like that.
"It's exactly that simple," I reply, not for the first time. "Waking up the dream state is a very straightforward business. It doesn't take decades. It doesn't look like tranquility or like a calm, peaceful mind. It doesn't look like saving others or saving the world or even saving yourself. It doesn't look like a thriving marketplace where merit is determined by popular appeal or commercial success. Waking up looks like a massive mental and emotional breakdown, because that's exactly what it is, the granddaddy of all breakdowns. That's the only way it works. I know there are thousands of books out there that say otherwise, and I can tell you that they were all written by Maya. Once you understand what Maya really is, once you see her for yourself, that becomes perfectly obvious. You'd see it
like you see the sky. He waves my own pages at me.
But you can't level these broad condemnations.
Why not? I ask. Am I wrong? Is there some purpose of spirituality other than to awaken from delusion? Is there some guiding principle other than truth? Am I wrong in thinking that Maya has thoroughly captured the hearts and minds of those who would seek to escape her? Are they not completely indoctrinated, enslaved by orthodoxy? Are they not sitting with their eyes closed, trying to quiet their minds and stop their thoughts? Are they not promoting peace and tranquility and silence as spiritual ideals? Are they not practicing a heart-centric, emotion-based spirituality? Do they not possess strong convictions and deeply held beliefs that bind them more securely than chains?
Yes, he says with a heavy sigh. You might be wrong.
It's taken a while to strong-arm him into saying that.
Exactly, I agree. I am wrong. There is some other purpose to spirituality. It's not about truth or awakening from delusion. It's about the exact opposite of that.
What?
I'm agreeing with you, I say.
It sounds like a very backhanded agreement, he says. I think that the issues here are more complex than you.
The only complex issue is staying benighted in a sunlit world. We have taken the simplest of all possible things and complicated it beyond comprehension. We have dreamed up these ridiculous spiritual ideals to which we can perpetually aspire but never attain. We have bought darkness in the name of light, lies in the name of truth, and ignorance in the name of knowledge. We have convinced ourselves that what could not be closer is most distant, that what is for all is only for the few, and that the one thing you cannot not attain is hopelessly beyond reach. That's the perfect recipe for a long and happy failure. In other words, that's the work of Maya, without whom there is no dream state in which to debate and write books, or from which to escape. Wouldn't anyone whose eyes were open and who saw this surreal situation clearly want to make some effort to describe what they were looking at?
Well, that might all depend on how you define.
I'm defining the dream state as a state in which a person sees what's not and doesn't see what is. Eyes closed, imagining reality instead of eyes open, observing it. With eyes closed, one is forced to live in an imagined, constantly conjured, faux reality.
The dream state, he says.
The non-lucid dream state, I say. I inhabit the same dream state as you, but I am lucid within it. Those who are non-lucid within it live behind closed eyes in an imagined world, an imagined reality. This imagined belief structure has no inherent stability and requires constant emotional reinforcement. This is most pronounced and visible with fundamentalism in any belief system. Their belief structures are the least stable and require the most emotional reinforcement. But it's true of everyone who's not awake.
News to me, he says a bit sourly.
No, it's not, I reply. Practically everyone who talks about awakening and enlightenment is really talking about some degree of simply opening their eyes. Nothing at all to do with truth realization. This is what all the mystical teachers and poets are really talking about. They've gotten a glimpse of the integrated state, a taste of lucidity, and it's like the most extraordinary thing to them. Really, though, it should be the most ordinary thing. It's only extraordinary because we are so cut off from it.
You're dismissing the entire spectrum of spiritual motivations and aspirations, he says. You're reducing this entire debate.
Yes, I agree.
I'm dismissing spiritual aspirations within the sleeping dream state. Quality of life issues like happiness, peace, health, prosperity, and so on, and salvation and life everlasting, to take it a small step further. Greed, vanity, ego, all arising from fear. Yes, I categorically dismiss all of that. It is the muck and mire in which mankind wallows, and from which sincere aspirants must extricate themselves. Bob shakes his head, as if I'm just not getting it. But I do get it. I understand his presence here, with me, at this time. I understood it within a few minutes of first meeting him. I know why he's here, from my perspective anyway. I'm speaking a bit forcefully to Bob, not because I want to penetrate his defenses, but because I want to observe them. It's Bob's impenetrability that I'm being shown, that is being put on display for my benefit, for the benefit of the book. Bob will probably be the last spiritual, New Age-type person I will ever spend time with. I still have Brett's eulogy in Virginia to deal with, and I won't have this kind of opportunity there. This is my last chance to see Maya up close and personal, to see how deftly she blocks and parries and deflects and absorbs every attempt to get past or through her, to try this and that angle, this and that point of entry, and to find all attempts effortlessly thwarted, to see how easily she does something so seemingly impossible. Bob knows all this. I shared it with him as soon as I saw it myself. He's not offended, and doesn't feel I'm being patronizing or condescending. For his part, he won't get from me what he came for, something to do with his book, but which is not mine to give. But I'm sure he'll get what he was meant to. I've met hundreds, maybe thousands of spiritual people, Jed, from all walks and disciplines, at all levels of development, from novice to famous masters. And I have to say, I think you're grossly mischaracterizing who these people are and what it is they're doing. Abiding non-dual awareness, human adulthood, and altered states, I say. That's all we have to work with. It's one of those, or it's just sitting at the bottom of a hole, passing the time, waiting to die. I say all this in complete non-judgment. You seem to think I'm trying to offend spiritual people, like I'm a mean guy saying mean things. But my only real interest is in trying to bring some common sense and clarity to the most muddled and elusive topic in the history of man. What actual people do with their actual lives is outside my small sphere of interest. To the best of my knowledge, spiritually inclined people from all walks and disciplines, at all stages, are really doing nothing more than maintaining or deepening their entrenchment, and maybe piddling around with mildly altered states. Now, maybe there's something I don't know. And if there is, I would be truly grateful to hear it. But what I do know is that very few spiritual people are divesting themselves of their egoic bonds and undergoing the death-rebirth process necessary to make the transition into human adulthood. And virtually no one is actually awakening from delusion. These subjects aren't even a part of the spiritual lexicon. Just to discuss these topics, I've had to devise a makeshift terminology. Truth realization, first step, the dream state, and the awakened state, human childhood and human adulthood, integrated and segregated states. These concepts are of the essence of human development, and yet we don't even have words for them. To his credit, Bob doesn't launch an immediate counter-assault. This is something we've discussed. The idea that I'm not trying to win his heart or convince his mind. That I'm just trying to say what I see and that it's all friendly and cordial and even, as far as I'm concerned, academic. I point to the book on the table between us. Have you read 1984? Back in high school, as I recall. I've been having a wonderful time with it. Orwell's original title was The Last Man in Europe, but the publishers asked him to change it. He went with 1984, of course. I think he should have just shortened it to The Last Man. Do you remember Newspeak? Yes, he says. They were cutting back the language. They kept coming out with new versions of the dictionary with less and less words. Double plus good, I say. Do you remember why? The reason for Newspeak? No, I don't think I knew there was a specific reason, besides general control and oppression. They were eliminating concepts, I say. They weren't just taking away people's freedom. They were taking away the idea of freedom. Eventually, the very thought of freedom would be unthinkable, because there would be no word for it. He looks puzzled. So you're saying what? They were moving towards some form of spiritual totalitarianism? Not at all. If that were the case, we'd see it coming like a black cloud rolling across the earth. What I'm saying is that it's already here. The reign of Big Brother is so firmly established that no alternative exists in the minds of men. The very concept of freedom has been so thoroughly abolished, is so absent from our collective worldview, that it is literally unthinkable. There is no possibility of human development in practice because it doesn't exist in theory. There's no such thing as a radical or a revolutionary anymore. There is no insurgency, no rebellion. There may be a few isolated pockets of plotters, but nothing even likely to arouse Maya's notice. There's no interest in freedom. It's all been channeled safely into non-threatening, ego-gratifying avenues, career and family, religion and spirituality, hobbies and addictions. Freedom has been effectively wiped out of existence. The idea no longer exists. The game is over. Well, that seems rather bleak. It's 1984 for mankind now, and probably will be forever. The real message we can take from Orwell's book has nothing to do with anything so trivial as political oppression or the erosion of privacy rights. It has to do with the reduction of man's perceptual faculties to a narrow field of vision, like blinders on a beast of burden, rendering us unaware of alternatives, knowing nothing other than slow, pointless plodding toward our own burial ground. 1984 isn't a future possibility. It's a present fact. I pick up the book and read a paragraph from the appendix. The purpose of Newspeak was not only to provide a medium of expression for the worldview and mental habits proper to the devotees of Ingsoc, but to make all other modes of thought impossible. It was intended that when Newspeak had been adopted once and for all, and Oldspeak forgotten, a heretical thought, that is, a thought diverging from the principles of Ingsoc, would be literally unthinkable, at least so far as thought is dependent on words. We're living in the Dark Ages, Bob. You don't see it, but I do. You think I'm saying something bad, but I'm delivering the best possible news. We can stop putting a positive spin on our circumstances and actually change them, radically improve them, far better than anything depicted in our fairy tales and mythologies and medieval superstitions. Bob is looking at me like I'm the bad guy. I sigh. You seem to think that I'm opposed to human spirituality, Bob. like I'm saying it's not a very effective path to freedom.
Isn't that what you are saying?
No. I'm saying it's unrelated. Spirituality is a state-sanctioned enterprise. None of those things, not Buddhism or Sufism or any New Age stuff or Hinduism or Kabbalah or anything else, pose any threat to the status quo. Their practice does not result in progress. I'm not saying they're bad at it, as you seem to think, but that it's outside their scope and charter. Religion and spirituality, as they have always been known, are of no practical value whatsoever. The individual who wants to explore life and their relationship to their universe must harden their heart, sharpen their mind, and strike out on their own. And what they'll find when they get clear of this whole mess is that humans may have come down from the trees, but we have yet to take our first step.
Well, evolution can take thousands of years.
I don't think so, Bob. Not this kind. My experience is that this kind of evolution isn't of the species, but of the individual. I'm not talking about what people can do together, but what one person can do alone, a serious person who is willing to make a fresh start and play the game as it is, not as they've been told it is or as they might wish it is. To strike out and test the limits of what it means to be a conscious being in a conscious universe is within the scope of the individual. Any group of two or more people are necessarily externalized and immobilized by their very togetherness, but a single individual can go and keep going.
Well, I'm certainly all for the individual, says Bob sportingly, but you can't deny the contributions of those who came before. It is the great teachers and texts dating from antiquity to modern science from which we receive our understanding and to which we owe a debt of science is just another belief system, and a fundamentalist belief system at that. No understanding means anything unless it translates into action, change, actual progress. Otherwise, it's just another evasive tactic. It's because we accept our meager illumination as full sunlight that we don't possess the explosive and self-destructive levels of discontent necessary to make a break. Not until we begin hacking away at our mental and emotional entanglements can we swim up and break the surface into the full light of wakefulness. And not until we do that can we understand in what a cold and miserable darkness mankind dwells. That's personal revolution, spiritual warfare. That's the only point there is to this whole business, and it doesn't look at all bleak to me. Over the course of many hours together, it becomes clear that Bob views me as some sort of party pooper, like I'm being a drag for not putting on a funny hat and singing along with the world community of spiritual merrymakers, like I'm a grouchy pessimist who sees only the dark side of things and has no hope for humanity. The truth is that I am probably the most optimistic, pro-human person there is. Mine is a realistic, pragmatic optimism, an optimism based on common sense and direct experience and easily verifiable results, not on religious fairy tales and mystical superpowers and New Age marketing hype. If I seem negative, it's because I know something of our potential. If I seem disrespectful of our great thinkers and spiritual leaders, it's because I see them not as liberators, but as unwitting co-conspirators in a crime against humanity, a crime of subjugation and spiritual castration. Everyone should be familiar with the terms like those I've been forced to invent, and many others. Books like Damnedest
and incorrect in warfare shouldn't be revolutionary or revelatory. They should be completely unnecessary, because everyone should be talking and writing about these subjects. Human development and potential should completely saturate our thinking, to the exclusion of all the diversionary fluff with which we stuff our heads. These topics should be as familiar to people as their mother tongue. Human adulthood should be as primary in education as Mortimer Adler's three R's: reading, writing, and reckoning. Everyone should be making the transition to human adulthood in their early teens, and it should be a celebrated life event, not the personal holocaust it is when it occurs belatedly. Truth realization would hardly be everyone's chief concern, but there's no reason for people who have an honest relationship with life not to know what it is. There should be no reason for a Jed McKenna. None of what I have to say should need saying, much less come as a surprise. The real issue here isn't that I'm so far ahead, but that humanity is so far behind. We can keep telling ourselves how wonderful we are, how brave and spirited, but that's a part of the pathology of our sleep disorder. We can keep sniffing around in outer space and on ocean bottoms and in laboratories in order to maintain our conviction that we're courageous explorers of the unknown, but that's symptomatic of the same pathology. Any and every outward pursuit is treated as noble and important because we're all in the same club, and those are the rules. Even warring and embittered factions within the club are in full agreement on this point. How can it be that we're essentially the same now as we were at the most distant reaches of recorded history? Why does our outer environment change while our inner landscape stays the same? Because that's the first rule of this club. Always outward, never inward. So it follows as a matter of certainty that anyone who espouses any teaching or doctrine or philosophy is necessarily a member of the club. Any spiritual teacher who allows students to ask questions and gives them answers is a member of the outward-only club, an unwitting, and thereby all the more insidious, agent of ignorance. The world is full of respected and beloved spiritual and religious teachers. People ask them questions, and they provide answers. Question and answer. Question and answer. On and on. Talk and more talk. More like spiritual therapy than spiritual warfare. But all questions, no matter how sincere or heartfelt, are really the same question. Outward? And all answers, no matter how profound or wise, are really the same answer. Yes. The subtext of every question is, am I making progress by asking questions and trying to understand the answers? And the subtext of every answer is, yes, you are going somewhere while sitting here, talking, or reading. This is progress. Be at peace. You are progressing and well progressed. That's the obvious lie we want to hear, and those who tell it most convincingly are the most respected and revered and sought after. A shining example of this is the much-beloved Ramana Maharishi. His core teaching, if you ask Bob or any of Ramana's many fans, is, ask yourself, who am I? So what's the problem with that? There is none. In fact, it's perfect. A complete spiritual teaching in five words. So perfect, in fact, that anyone who actually does it will actually awaken. Ask yourself, who am I? If you do it, you will become enlightened. There is no possible alternative. The only way self-inquiry can fail to work is if you fail to do it. That's a pretty important point. So I'll say it again. The only way self-inquiry, ask yourself, who am I, can fail to result in enlightenment is if you fail to do it. So, I ask Bob, whose book is dedicated to Ramana, why aren't Ramana's many thousands of adoring students and devotees awake? That seems like a pretty fair question, doesn't it? I don't think it's fair to assume, he begins. No need to be defensive, I say. I'm agreeing with Ramana. I'm saying self-inquiry is the bomb. I'm completely on board. But you're also saying, what are you saying? That Ramana's failure to produce awakened beings was nearly total. Oh, well, that's hardly when, on the face of it, his success rate should be total. Shouldn't it? I don't know. I suppose. So what are we missing? Why isn't this adding up? What aren't we understanding about this? I glance over at Bob as he chews on the problem. He is visibly agitated, experiencing a degree of spiritual dissonance, it's safe to assume. He's sure Ramana was a great man, a great teacher, a saint, a sage, whatever he thinks all that means. That's the inner belief. But even after trying to quibble about Ramana's success rate for 15 deleted paragraphs, he has to agree that it's abysmal at best. That's the outer reality. Eventually, he can no longer help but see the obvious. They're not doing it, he says, making it a question. Who's not doing what? Followers of Ramana. They're not doing the self-inquiry practice. Yes, I agree. If we stated the situation correctly, self-inquiry leads to awakening, and Ramana's followers don't awaken. Then, that's the only conclusion we can come to. So then, if that's his teaching, then why don't his students practice it? I just don't think, he starts and stops, then starts again. I don't agree that, I mean, I've done it myself, you know. I've practiced self-inquiry. The sincere practice of self-inquiry would require a year or two of excruciatingly intense processing to go all the way through, I say, cutting off his attempt to scurry out a back door. It's not like a question to be answered, or an epiphany to be realized, or a thought to be pondered. It's more like a mountain of ignorance that has to be pulverized into particulate, stone by stone. Do you understand that? He sees that door slam shut. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So you didn't actually do it. He sits quietly for a while. Well, I thought I did, I suppose. I kind of thought I was doing it by following Ramana's teachings, by reading and trying to understand the dialogues and the books written about him. I guess I thought the whole thing was this sort of process of self-inquiry. I thought that if you were into Ramana Maharishi, that's what it meant, that you were doing self-inquiry just by learning what he taught. The inner 12-year-old is thus revealed. Here's this intelligent, accomplished, distinguished-looking guy seeing his fabrications dismantled, like a kid caught cheating by the teacher. As opposed to a specific process, I ask. No, there was a kind of process, too. I did this thing where I'd go into a sort of introspective mode. Well, once in a while. Like, I'd ask myself, who is experiencing this? Who is having this conversation with Jed right now? Who is out sunning himself on this beautiful day? I'm not too surprised to hear about Bob's weak and ineffectual method of self-inquiry. witnessing in its mildest and least disruptive form. I don't assume that if I had this conversation with a random sampling of 1,000 Ramana devotees that I'd get these same responses, but I do assume none of them would be awake. And though I don't think that many would claim to be awake, I do think that most or all would claim to be making real progress in that direction. Looking at Ramana Maharishi and self-inquiry affords us a very clear view of this phenomenon. But now that we know what we're looking for, we can increase our altitude and broaden our perspective and take a random sampling of all spiritual seekers. Why isn't anyone going anywhere? Because they've convinced themselves that they are going somewhere. Why? Because their spiritual masters and advisors tell them they are. Why are their spiritual masters and advisors telling them they're going somewhere? To get the gig. We pick our teachers. We get what we wish for. We want cozy, uninterrupted slumber and the dream of spiritual progress. And that's what we get. If all Ramana had ever said was, "Ask yourself, who am I?" If that had been his answer to every single question put to him, then he'd have been the perfect teacher with the perfect teaching. But no one would have ever heard of him, and we wouldn't be discussing him now. We know about him because of all the thousands of questions people asked him, and all the thousands of answers he gave. But every single one of those questions was the exact same question. Outward? And every single answer he gave was the exact same answer. Yes. Self-inquiry was not Ramana's core teaching. That's Maya's shell game, and we're the suckers lining up eager to get fleeced. But as every swindler and con man knows, you can't cheat an honest man. Ramana's true core teaching, if you care to pull the curtain back and look, was outward. In real progress, there are no questions or answers. There is no knowledge or teaching. There is only going and not going. Inward. The book 1984 takes place in the country of Osinia, where the motto, which Thomas Pynchon perceptively called the koans of an aberrant form of Zen, is, "War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength." Osinia is governed by 4 ministries, the names of which exhibit a sort of impudence in their deliberate reversal of the facts. The Ministry of Love is where all the torture and brainwashing are done. The Ministry of Peace wages a never-ending war. The Ministry of Plenty is in charge of restricting the supply of food and goods. The Ministry of Truth is in charge of lies and propaganda. In keeping with that impudent naming practice, we can look to our own Ministry of Awakening, the spiritual marketplace, where we find all the sages and teachers and philosophers and scholars hard at work doing exactly what our own big brother, Maya, wants them to be doing, making sure everyone stays sound asleep. Chapter 20. Ordinary Superpowers. Prayer is not an old woman's idle amusement. Properly understood and applied, it is the most potent instrument of action. Mahatma Gandhi. In this book, I'm putting a lot of emphasis on the daily reality of the person who is awake within the dream state, the lucid dreamer, who is able, not as a random event, but as a matter of course, to shape his living reality in ways and to a degree that might be considered by the non-lucid dreamer as the stuff of fantasy fiction. That's certainly how it looks from the respectable point of view. But we have no time for respectability here. If I needed anyone else's respect, I realized long ago, I wouldn't have my own. If we want to get anywhere or understand anything, respectability has to be discarded like the refuge of fear it is. When we were looking at the influence of unseen forces in daily affairs, in the acquisition of a house or a dog, in the rightness of a motorcycle accident, in the writing of a book, in the way the ball bounces or the cookie crumbles, the overarching significance is not that these unseen forces are miraculous powers of the few, but the natural and rightful abilities of all. They are commonly dabbled with and dimly perceived, and called by many names from the eyes-closed, segregated perspective. But they can only be truly possessed and developed from the eyes-open, integrated perspective. When, after I scrambled to come up with the buying price, the house I was trying to buy in Ahis fell through, I was not dismayed or disappointed. I knew exactly what was going on, even though I had absolutely no idea. Then, when the other house, my lifelong ideal house, became available shortly thereafter, I wasn't shocked or amazed. I was pleased and grateful. When Maya, the dog, appeared, I wasn't falling all over myself in a panic to acquire her. I recognized her immediately, because I had been moving toward her for months. It never occurred to me that she wouldn't become mine. I wasn't at all surprised to learn that her current owners were trying to find a new home for her. I can go on with stories like these, and on and on. I could write pages every evening about the patterns that had been visible in various stages of unfolding only that day, of waves just becoming visible as distant swells, of waves building and cresting, of waves crashing and washing up the shoreline and receding back into the ocean. From these patterns, I know what will happen and, just as importantly, what won't. I didn't know the first house deal would fall through, but I knew it was part of a larger process that was yet to be fully revealed, and I never suspected that bad luck had befallen me, or that the universe was acting in some malevolent or random fashion. When my grand uncle's house came into the picture, and me and the highly unlikely position to act on it, I wasn't flabbergasted or stunned. I was like a kid who claps in delight when a magician, after a suspenseful build-up, makes a pony appear. The best lessons come from all the small, everyday stories, stories of smooth, effortless functioning, of doing less and accomplishing more, of ease and contentment and unwavering, never misplaced trust. When something seems to go wrong, it's invariably part of a larger right. I eat when hungry, sleep when tired, walk when I feel like walking, zone out, or work, or nap, or read when I feel like it. I am neither lazy nor industrious. I never do anything I don't feel like doing, and nothing ever goes undone. When I think of something I'd rather be doing, I do it. If I were to develop an authentic desire to, say, climb Mount Everest, then the wherewithal to do so would appear in a timely and effortless fashion. If I were to develop an inauthentic desire to climb Everest, then I would quickly recognize it as such and let it fall away. If this were just about me, if I were somehow special, it wouldn't be worth mentioning. But it's not about me. It's about everyone. It's about who and what we are here in the dream state. It's about how things really work, or how they can work, if we open our eyes and look and participate. I'm in the sand at Bratz. A woman in the front row named Karen raises her hand. You said in your second book that if we don't have the desire to move into human adulthood, we should pray for it. Can you talk more about prayer? How to do it? How it works? Others chime in. It's a popular topic. Sure, we can talk about prayer if you like, I say. Prayer is a real thing, and it really works. But the word prayer is kind of weak and misleading. It's a segregated, eyes-closed term for an integrated, eyes-open process. It's a child's way of explaining adult things, like saying that babies are delivered by a stork. That's charming and amusing until you want to grow up and start having kids. Then you're going to need a better idea of how things really work. Or like a child saying airplanes are held up by fairy powder. It's a cute explanation, but if you want to get a plane to stay up, you're going to need a more realistic understanding of aerodynamics. Okay, Karen says, but it's not pure science, is it? You still have to be deserving somehow, don't you? Yes, I say, in the same way that a plane has to be deserving of staying in the air. If it obeys the rules, it's deserving. If it doesn't obey the rules, it falls down. Instant karma. We can participate in shaping our reality to a far greater degree than a word like prayer would suggest, but we have to understand the basic principles and reshape ourselves to them. Everyone is attentive now. This is starting to sound like the Fountain of Youth, Santa's lap, and a winning lottery ticket all rolled into one. They see that Brett has an idyllic, stress-free lifestyle, away from the world and surrounded by beauty and tranquility and the animals she loves. They know from the books and some talk on the subject that I live comfortably, that I don't struggle or put up with much unpleasantness. They can see that we live well, but not ostentatiously. Simple, comfortable, unornamented, and unadorned, yet lacking nothing. They think we know something about quality of life and about shaping our environment, and we do. They hope that this knowledge is something they can use in their own lives to make profound improvements, and it is. Do you know what I'm talking about? I ask them rhetorically. It's not just manifestation. It's good and bad luck. It's being in and out of the flow. It's about things going your way or going against you. It's not fickle or random. It's a process of visible patterns, and we can see them and learn to move with them. If you can detect the outlines of this, feel your relationship to it, see how it works when it does, and why it doesn't when it doesn't, then you can start the process of reverse engineering it, dissecting it, observing it to better understand how it works and put it to work more and better in your own life. And by doing that, you will be dismantling your own ego structure. Because ego is always the thing that gets in the way, that tries to steer us across or against the natural currents of being. Am I starting to sound like a hippie? They laugh. Luck is like prayer, I tell them. Insofar as it's an eyes-closed explanation of things that can be seen and understood with eyes open, like storks and fairy powder. Fate is another example. These terms are like the superstitions of primitive people to explain things they barely see and don't understand.
"Hey, wait a minute," says a young guy named Logan in a tone of mock indignation. "Did you just call us primitives?"
That gets a laugh.
"Actually, yes," I say, and they quiet down.
"I mean, how would you define primitive people?
People who are not highly developed. People with beliefs we would probably consider unsophisticated, maybe even comical. People who live in conditions we would consider substandard. People who make up far-fetched stories to explain processes they don't understand. People who could elevate themselves out of these conditions, but don't. Would everyone agree with that?"
No one says they wouldn't.
"Then yes, someone established in the integrated state would certainly apply the term spiritual primitive to anyone in the segregated state. And with far more justification, I would think, than we might apply the word primitive to anyone we'd see in the pages of National Geographic."
A weighty hush descends over the group.
"Well, how exactly are we supposed to take that?" asks Logan.
"Everything I say should be taken as an invitation," I reply.
"An invitation to participate in your own life, to take personal responsibility for your own development, instead of abdicating it to churches or clergy or gurus. You should take it as wonderful news. Yes, compared to your potential, you are developmentally stunted and spiritually primitive, but you don't have to be. In the sense that you are a primitive, your evolution is within your control. I was in this state. Brett was in this state. And we saw that it was highly undesirable and clawed our way out of it. It can be done. Whether we set our sights on spiritual growth or enlightenment or truth realization or adulthood, it all starts out the same way. I mean, that's what you're here for, isn't it? To grow, to explore, to change?" That was a better question than I understood at the time. "What about things like astrology and numerology and tarot," someone asks, "and all the other methods of insight and divination? How does all that factor in?"
"Good question," I say. "All these various methods that aid us in knowing what to do and when to do it are rendered unnecessary and obsolete as soon as we open our eyes and see our environment and how to operate in it. This urge to gain some measure of control stems directly from the eyes-closed, fear-based perspective. It's a symptom of the segregated state, of operating from a place of fear and distrust, of keeping a death grip on the tiller and feeling that your mind, your little brain, is in charge, of feeling that you are an unwanted guest in a hostile world, and you need to arm yourself in order to survive and thrive. Once we move into the integrated state and get our bearings, all such urges are forgotten. Methods of divination might make very good sense in the segregated state, but it makes a lot more sense to find your way into the integrated state, where you'd have no further use for such methods. I move in alignment with clearly visible forces and energies, so all other methods and forms of navigation, whether star charts or stock charts or weather charts or anything else, are of no more use to me than a seeing-eye dog. I have no need to avail myself of navigational aids for the visually impaired. I can see for myself. You can too. That's the point of all of this." We take a break, during which several people come up to me to voice their views in support of astrology and tarot and other such things, but they're all children's toys. And when we grow up, we leave them behind, and I can't think of anything more to say about them. After 20 minutes, we all get situated and enjoy a few minutes of open dialogue. Karen complains, half-jokingly, that she's always prayed for a certain car, but never got it, which provides an adequate segue back into our main theme. If you think of this process of manifestation as a way of getting what you want, I say, then you're already off track. The way it really works is more of a seamless unfolding. It's not something you can improve, only impede. The only way you can make it work better is to remove ego from the equation. As soon as you start imposing your beliefs on the process, it necessarily begins to degrade, even to impose your beliefs about time and space on the process, or your beliefs about causality and duality, is to diminish it. As soon as you start asserting your beliefs, you start closing it down to your level instead of opening yourself up. And since, furthermore, this process is really about conscious being, about who and what and where we are, developing a progressively deeper understanding of the process is synonymous with actual progress and growth. Same thing, okay? Lots of unconvincing nods. Brett weighs in. "I hope y'all are listening," she hollers from her seat. "This ain't no New Age gimmick or some late-night infomercial where bikini models are washing a Ferrari in front of a mansion that could all be yours for 3 easy payments." She stands and walks out front with me. "We're living in a corrupt world," she tells them in her most forceful tone. "There ain't but one malevolent force in the universe, and we are it. It ain't that we're bad people. It's that we ain't fully formed. And what you get then is an abomination. Y'all know what an abomination is? It's like what them Chinese princesses do to their feet, keeping them all bound up so they stay tiny instead of growing to their rightful size. Them feet is an abomination. But the cause of them feet is this corruption I'm talking about. Priests who molest children is an abomination. Politicians and corporations violating the people's trust is an abomination. Every single one of us, even if we never done a wrong thing, is an abomination as much as the worst folks you can name. You could make a list of human abominations that'd wrap from here to the moon and back. But I reckon there ain't really but one corruption at the heart of all abomination, and that's ego. There might be millions of symptoms, but there ain't but one cause." She pauses to let that set in and continues her color commentary. "Now, I know what y'all are sitting here thinking. You think Mr. McKenna is going to let you in on some big secret, and then you're going to be living on Easy Street because you'll have some special knowledge that gives you special powers. And in a way, that's right, but not in the way that gets you a sports car or makes you a bikini model. He's talking about the same thing we always talk about here. The only thing there is worth talking about. Nasty, disgusting, repulsive, slimy ego. Y'all are gonna want to put all this magic to work in your lives, and that's fine. I reckon you can do that in some small way. But if you're gonna play with this shiny new toy, you should try putting it to some good use. Use it to get yourself shook loose of all those layers of armor and baggage and filth you're dragging everywhere and calling by your own name. Get your ass naked. Peel off all that crap so you can live your life direct instead of piecing it together based on rumor and speculation like you do now. Desire it. Pray for it. Manifest it. Ask the tooth fairy for it. But use these things Mr. McKenna's telling you about to get your ass woke up. So when your life is over, you can look back and say you were in it and didn't just sleep through it like you're doing now.
Brett resumes her seat. I resume where I'd left off.